But in Australia, we kind of have this bizarre debate where the starting point is always the status quo. Like, whatever we happen to have today is kind of chiseled in stone, handed to us on divine
tablets.
And if you want to change one, then that's class envy, it's a war, it's divisive. Like, we're just literally not allowed to have a conversation about, is the tax system in 2021 working the way we want?
One for mum, one for dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're going to talk about one of life's great certainties, taxes.
We are the party of lower taxes, Mr. Speaker.
Which is, we are the party of lower taxes.
One in three of Australia's biggest corporations pays no tax. And while the rest of the country was hit hard during the pandemic, Australian billionaires' wealth increased by a third, with some doubling their...
This government treats taxpayers' money like its own, like its Liberal Party money. That has to stop.
That income tax cuts will be brought forward and business tax breaks will be in the budget with Scott Morrison.
We are the party of lower taxes.
The Liberal National Government has, for example, passed income tax cuts worth hundreds of billions of dollars and tried to cut taxes for companies and a range of other things. And the Labor Party has just announced it will dump some policies that it took to the last election, like reforms to negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount.
Labor campaigned hard against future tax cuts that would most benefit high-income earners.
Labor this week dumped its signature housing plan of limiting negative gearing to new properties and halving the 50% capital gains tax deduction.
As Labor leader, I am absolutely determined to look to the future, not relitigate the past.
Carbon taxes, goods and services taxes, wealth taxes, super profit taxes. There are many different kinds of taxes that governments can levy to raise revenue. So today we're going to talk about good taxes and bad taxes and the economics behind taxation. And I'm joined by our chief economist, Richard Dennis, and senior economist, Matt Grudnoff. G'day, Richard and Matt. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Eb.
Hey, Eb.
So, Matt, we released this research earlier this week that outlines kind of five sets of principles that will help people to evaluate the merits of different types of taxes. What are the reasons why we thought this report was important?
Well, basically, you can tax in enormous different ways, lots of different ways. You can tax lots of different rates. And all over the world, countries do it in very different ways. And so what we thought was, coming out of the recession, going forward, there's going to be a debate about what kind of taxes we should have. And we thought that the best way to do that was to start from first principles and ask, well, what makes a good tax and what makes a bad tax? So that going forward, we can look at all of these myriad of different tax options and we can choose some of the better ones rather than sort of avoid some of the worst ones.
And so the Australia Institute is often fond of saying that great quote that tax is the price we pay for civilization. The report sets out five principles that will help people evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of different taxes. Can you just outline these for me before we kind of dive in?
Yeah, so the first principle is about behavioural change. Most of the time, economists don't like behavioural change in the sense that they don't want their taxes to change people's behaviour. But sometimes they actually do want to change behaviour. So carbon tax is a great example. When we introduce a carbon tax, what we're trying to do is get people to change their behaviour to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So our first principle is that the tax should minimise change unless it's designed to reduce something, in which case it should maximise that change.
So we don't care if people buy pizza or hamburger for dinner. Like, you know, economists are generally a bit libertarian. We think people should choose what shoes they should wear and what hat they should wear and what they should have for lunch. But when as a society we think, well, we do want to discourage carbon pollution or we do want to discourage smoking, then it makes perfect sense to use the tax system to help distort the economy. but distort it in a desirable, deliberate, strategic way.
That has good outcomes for society overall.
Yeah, and here's where it gets interesting, and this is outside of the realm of economics. We can't always agree when we want to do the distorting. Like, some people think, well, why should we discourage people from smoking? And yeah. Some people say, well, why should we discourage people from having really noisy cars or polluting lots of carbon pollution? And they're democratic decisions, ultimately. But once we collectively agree that we want to discourage an activity, then a tax can be an effective way to do it. So there's a bit of democracy in setting the goals, and then the economics is really quite simple.
Okay. Principle two, Matt, is that the tax measure should reduce inequality. Why is that a principle?
For a couple of reasons. The first thing is we know that societies or countries that have lower levels of inequality actually grow faster than societies that are very unequal. And so in order to grow the economy, reducing inequality is a good way to go. And we also know that one of the best ways to reduce inequality is through the tax system and also through government spending, through the transfer system. So knowing that taxes is one of the best ways to reduce inequality, and knowing that inequality not only has social benefits but also economic benefits, we thought that a good principle was that the tax should reduce inequality.
And Matt's such an economist, you left out the obvious bit. Most people want to live in a more equal society. So if you want to discourage...
Most, I like that we had to qualify that with most.
Oh, there's some out there that love a bit of inequality. Usually people that started with a head start.
Yeah.
But no, everything Matt said is true, but when we ask people in Australia, when we ask people around the world, when we ask people over time, most people say they'd rather live in a society where the gap between those with the most and those with the least isn't too big. So just as if you want to discourage smoking, then a tobacco tax is a good idea. If you want to make society a more equal place, a progressive income tax is a good idea. And nearly every democratic country in the world has one, so there's a hint. And Australia has always had one, so there's a hint. So, yeah, if you want to get rid of inequality, that's a democratic goal. A progressive tax system and a well-designed tax system generally, like a wealth tax system, can help reduce that inequality.
Hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are locked down, locked out of paid work, housing prices have gone through the roof, and today we're discussing again giving people on some of the highest incomes in the country $17 billion in tax cuts. Overwhelmingly that will go to higher income people with jobs, and most of them are men.
Principle three, the tax measure should be levelled on those who are best able to pay. Why is that a principle?
There's no point levelling a tax on somebody if they can't pay, or it puts them in stress to be able to pay. So if we levelled a tax on something that was unrelated to how much you earn or how much you have, then somebody might struggle to actually pay it. And so when we're thinking about what kind of tax we should have, we should think about their ability to pay that tax.
Yeah. So imagine, like we said before, sometimes you want to distort behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take that to the extreme. A good way to get people out of poverty would be to put a poverty tax on. Like, let's tax the poor to give them an incentive, some behavioural change. So sometimes we might want to achieve a behavioural change, but if we look carefully, we think, well, if we use tax to achieve that change, we're going to really put some people in a hard way. So let's not use the tax to change behaviour when we know that some people couldn't literally pay it.
And presumably part of the reason why governments levy taxes is to raise revenue, and you can't raise any revenue from people who can't afford to pay it.
No, and you can often send people to jail for failure. And this is like a good example of this is fines. In some jurisdictions, a large number of people wind up in jail for unpaid fines. So everyone agrees that you should fine people for speeding or fine people for drink driving, or there's lots of reasons to fine people. But if you're not careful about it, you can actually end up spending far more imprisoning people than you would have collected from them from a fine that they can't afford to pay.
Which reminds me that listeners should know that the Australia Institute has also done some work on progressive fines, so that the more you earn, the more you would pay, for example, for a speeding fine.
Principle number two, Eb.
That's right, to make the disincentive equal. Matt, principle four is that the tax measure should be simple to comply with, simple to administer, and easy to understand.
Yeah, look, complexity creates the ability for people to avoid a tax. So
loopholes.
Exactly. Our income tax, you know, if you sat down and you read all the rules and regulations on income tax, they are massive. They are huge. The tax code is enormous. And what that enormous complex thing does. It allows people to pay really smart accountants to be able to avoid that tax. So one of the reasons we want a simple system is because it's easy to administer, but it's also more difficult to avoid.
And again, like, it's so complicated that at one point the tax office sat down and went, you know, we should start again. We should start from scratch. We should write a whole new tax act that's a lot simpler. And they got halfway through and went, oh man, this is just too much. So now we actually kind of have multiple tax bills because we rewrote some of it, but like, we couldn't finish rewriting it all. Yeah, while it's fascinating, if you hear the business community speak, if you hear sort of advocates for rich people, whoever they might be, you'll always hear them say, oh, we need a simpler tax system. Well, I agree with them 1,000%, and that's not really a thing 100 will do. But when they say a simpler tax system, they mean lower taxes. All of that complexity is a design feature. All of that complexity helps people who earn enormous amounts of money pay enormous amounts of money to accountants in order to reduce the amount of tax they pay. And what you need to understand is that in Australia, we really have a kind of two-tier tax system. There's the middle-class tax system that most people encounter, and they either fill out their tax return themselves or they pay $100 to an accountant, and that's kind of job done. And that's most people. And then there's these other people, and we know this, who literally spend tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on accounting. And that expenditure to create family trusts, to create self-managed super funds, to create all sorts of complicated legal vehicles, the legal costs and the accounting costs to set them up are really high. So if you earned 100 grand a year, you would never spend 100 grand a year on tax advice. But if you earn $10 million a year and you spend $100,000 on tax advice, you might save yourself $1 million in tax.
And if we have a look at the tax stats, we can actually see that there's about 70 odd people a year.
Don't call them odd.
Well, you know, around 70 people. You're so pedantic. Around 70 people who earn $1 million a year but pay no tax. So effectively, they earn more than $1 million a year, but they have so many deductions that they reduce their taxable income to basically zero. And we also know that on average, they spend about $300,000 or $400,000 a year on tax advice.
So you're saying we should give them unemployment benefits, Matt, because they're so poor.
They're so poor. They have no income at all.
And that brings us to the last principle, principle 5. The tax measure should be difficult for those it's levelled on to avoid. So we don't want loopholes.
Exactly right. So this is basically fairly obvious. You don't want a tax system where people can just easily avoid the tax. Otherwise, you're only catching some people out.
The GST was the dawn of a new taxation era for Australians.
The GST is a great bag of smelly fish.
It's time to fight back.
There's no way that GST will ever be part of our policy.
Never, ever.
Never, ever. It's dead.
GST revenue has been in decline since it came in. But it's periods of recession like here during the GFC or right now during the coronavirus with the drop in revenue.
You, in the paper, go through a couple of different kinds of taxes and really run this ruler over them to see whether or not they come out as a good tax or a bad tax. Those are quite pejorative terms, but listeners will get where we're going with that. So to begin with, I want to start with the GST, the Goods and Services Tax. How does that fare against these principles?
Well, so basically we had a look at the Goods and Services Tax and we basically just took our five principles and said, well, does it meet that principle? Yes, a little bit, or no. And so on desired impact on behaviour, the GST is pretty good if it's fairly broad. So a goods and services tax, if it's levelled on most things that people buy, then they're not going to change their behaviour and buy more of something and less of something else if the tax is on most things.
But we deliberately, for example, left the GST off fresh food. It was a big fight. The Democrats at the time in the Senate insisted on it. Treasury was very upset about it. But the Democrats and others were saying, but we want fresh food to be relatively cheaper.
Yeah.
So you had a whole bunch of economists at Treasury going, we must have everything taxed the same amount. That's so neat. we won't have any distortions. And then you had a whole bunch of humans saying, well, we'd quite like to have some distortions, thanks. Yeah. So it's
no accident.
We want
people to eat vegetables.
Yeah, well, I would like to make it slightly more attractive for them to do that. But we also, and you often hear people saying we should broaden the base of the GST. It's not just fresh food we left out. We accidentally left out private school fees, and we accidentally left out private health insurance.
Accidentally. Yes, randomly.
Just randomly. And these things have grown incredibly rapidly ever since, not just because of it, but the GST isn't collecting as much revenue as we once thought it would because a growing percent of the population is spending a growing proportion of their whole income on $10,000, $30,000 school fees and expensive private health insurance.
Yeah, well, it's not cheap, is it?
GST on breastfeeding aids applies, and yet you could easily classify breastfeeding aids as either healthcare or fresh food, which are both GST, both GST free. By what authority is it determined that they're not GST free? Is it an ATO decision or somebody else makes that decision?
Back to the goods and services tax. Does it reduce inequality?
No. So the GST is what economists call a regressive tax. And basically what that means is that the less income you earn, the larger as a proportion of your income that you pay in tax. And that's bad for inequality. So imagine somebody on a low income, they probably spend 100% of their income just to buy the basic things that they need every day. But if you take somebody on, you know, $500,000 a year, they probably save upwards of half their income because they don't need to spend all of it just to meet the basic needs. And so therefore they're only paying GST, if the GST was levelled on everything, on about half their income.
So to be clear, because there's no GST on the money you save, if you're rich enough to save a lot of money, you pay less GST. Yeah. So a low-income earner spending 100% of their income is effectively paying GST on all of their income.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're wealthy enough to be saving a large share of your income, no GST payable.
Mm. What about being levelled on those best able to pay?
Well, yes and no. So this one's a bit of a mixed bag. When you're buying something, you know, you've probably got an ability to pay, but because it's a fairly regressive tax and it tends to target low-income earners and they have less income, then that can cause problems.
And when the GST was introduced, it was introduced with kind of compensation to help low-income earners, like we boosted unemployment benefits, we boosted benefits in general in order to help compensate. But guess what, over time, we actually kind of chipped away at the generosity of the welfare system. So
it also introduced income tax cuts, but we haven't chipped away at those.
Didn't chip away at those.
Either. Simple to administer and understand?
Well, I don't know whether you were around when and remember the introduction of the GST, but it was a schmozzle, and that's a nice way of putting it. We had, you know, the introduction of quarterly business activity statements, BAS statements, and they didn't exist before, and they were basically introduced so that suddenly firms were collecting the GST. So the Australian Tax Office is usually the one that collects tax on behalf of the federal government, and suddenly businesses were having to collect. So the GST was levelled on the businesses, and then they would pass it on to consumers. And so there was a whole heap of complexity that suddenly business had to do. And also, because the GST was levelled on some things and not other things, there was also a lot of complexity in when it first came out in deciding, well, what should it be levelled on, what shouldn't it be? You might remember the famous cake interview where John Hewson was asked, would, you know, the GST be levelled on this particular cake?
Well, depends if it has candles, Matt.
Exactly right. So, you know, there was a lot of complexity. But that said, now that the whole system's now in place, it tends to run fairly smoothly.
Mm. And lastly, difficult to avoid.
Oh, it depends. I mean, it's very hard for a big business. Like Woolworths don't avoid any of their GST. All the money goes into the cash registers, and it's actually very simple for them to collect. But when the GST was introduced, we were actually told it would stamp out tax evasion. It would stamp
just
out...
Just get rid of it completely.
Oh, imagine that. Neoliberals overselling their agenda. But what's actually happened now is that the GST, because it's imposed on goods and services, has actually given a lot of service providers, plumbers, electricians, a whole bunch of people that provide services, an incentive to offer their customers. So if I come to your house and say, well, that'll be $1,000 plus GST, or if you'll pay me $1,000 in cash, you can save the GST and I'll pocket the $1,000 and won't pay any income tax on it at all. So actually in the services sector, which is a lot harder to monitor than the goods sector, in the services sector, arguably the GST has actually created an incentive for tax evasion, because both sides of the evasion can benefit. The consumer can save some GST, the supplier can save some income tax, and the black economy has clearly grown since the GST came in.
Welcome back to Squawk. Senator Elizabeth Warren unveiling a proposal to tax the wealthy.
The existing income tax, the existing tax system, are largely escaped by mega millionaires and billionaires.
The wealthy are definitely undertaxed relative to the general population.
I want to go in a different direction and now talk about a super profits tax. How does that fare against our five principles overall?
Well, a super profits tax is a particular... Like, we have a company tax rate in Australia. We tax companies when they make a profit. A super profits tax isn't a tax on superannuation. It's a tax on really big profits. We kind of have one of these in banking at the moment. Like, we have a specific levy on the big banks because they're just that profitable. And Labor proposed one for the mining industry back when Kevin Rudd was around. So a super profits tax basically says, all right, there's no competition or not much competition in parts of the economy. The profits they're making are outrageous. We try and regulate them. It doesn't work. We try and introduce competition. It doesn't work. Stuff it. Let's just tax them, because at least then the public can get a slice of the benefits. So, yeah, big picture, good idea. But Matt, how's it go with your criteria?
Well, so desired impact on behaviour. Now, this is the great thing about a super profits tax. It doesn't change behaviour at all. So if you went to a business and they were making super enormous profits...
Is that an economic term?
That is super enormous. Look it up. It's in every economics textbook. Super enormous profits. And you said, I'm going to tax you a bit more on just that part that's outlandishly huge... So you'll only earn half as much of the super profits, then you're not going to then turn around and go, well, that's it, I'm going to get out of this industry or reduce it.
I read the newspapers, Matt, and every company in Australia would pack up and leave. They would go offshore. They'd say, if you're going to make me pay some tax here, I'd rather make nothing. Yeah. And I'm going to go somewhere else.
And that's exactly the point. If you're making massive profits, you're going to continue to do the thing that makes you massive profits, even if the government takes a slightly larger share of those massive profits.
I'm saying they're just making stuff up.
I think that they're... I think you're being fooled, Richard, fooled.
It also seems to tick the box on reducing inequality, levied against those best able to pay.
Obviously, it reduces inequality because those that are earning super profits are the ones that have the most. Ability to pay, well, by definition, you're making a mozza. And simple to administer and easily understood. Well,
pretty easy. We've already got a tax system.
People tend to struggle a little bit with understanding the super profits tax, but I mean, it certainly wouldn't slow it or make it more difficult to administer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the few problems is companies kind of restructuring themselves to avoid it. Say, well, if you're going to put a special tax on my special profit above a particular amount, I'll create a subsidiary or I'll kind of change my behaviour.
So it only got a partial tick for difficult to avoid.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Yeah. And when we see how they avoid it, we say, thanks for that. Now we're going to amend the law.
Millions of Australians have been given tax cuts tonight worth between $20 and $50 a week.
Changes would eventually see all income between $45,000 and $200,000 taxed at 30%, a move that'll cost about $17 billion a year initially and benefit particularly middle and higher income earners.
We have stage three is the least responsible, least affordable, least fair.
But time. Labor vowing not to repeal an already legislated but still to be implemented tax cut that would see someone on $200,000, $9,000 a year better off.
So what you can always know from Labor, when you hear that they want to spend more, always know that they want to tax you more.
I know we've got a bunch of different kind of taxes in here that we could run the ruler over, but I wanted to finish on income tax because it is one that everyone pays and because the Stage 3 income tax cuts are about to flatten our progressive income tax system, which we've talked a lot about. So income tax overall, Matt, how does that fare against the principles?
Well, on the second principle, reducing inequality, progressive income tax is great at doing that. Unfortunately, when the Stage 3 tax cuts come in, it will be less effective at that. But certainly progressive income tax, the more you earn, the bigger as a proportion of your income you pay in tax. As far as change in desired behaviour, well, we don't want people to earn less income. We don't want to discourage them from going out and working. And because it taxes income, you could say perhaps there is a discouraging effect on that.
So rich people say, I'd rather be poor than pay some tax. I'm back, Matt.
Exactly right. So it's only for groups, though. So somebody on $200,000 a year who is salaried, probably, you know, if you increase their income tax, they're not going to change their behaviour at all. But for example, somebody, the second income earner in a household with a family, who's thinking, will I go back part-time or stay home and look after the kids, then, you know, how much childcare is and how much income tax is could change that decision. So if the income tax was higher, they might go, well, it's just not worth going back to work.
But let's be clear, the Stage 3 tax cuts will give a $9,000 a year tax cut to people earning over $200,000 a year.
Those who aren't likely to change their behaviour.
These are the least likely group in the economy to change their behaviour because of the tax.
And the bottom 20% will get nothing.
They get
absolutely
nothing.
Zero. And they're the ones that are most likely to change their behaviour.
Okay. And across the other types of things, reducing inequality, you've talked about the progressiveness, best able to pay, only partially simple to administer. I'm guessing that's because we've got the different levels of taxation across all the different incomes.
Income tax could be more simple if you got rid of almost all of the deductions or all of the deductions.
Yep.
You could make it simple, but the reality is how it is now, it's incredibly complicated.
Yeah. Okay. As anyone that fills out their tax return knows, it's a long form in Australia. It's a lot simpler in some countries.
Yeah. So now I want to go past a couple of other ones and just really quickly, if you could give me a bit of a summary about whether or not it's a good or bad tax according to these principles, and for each of them, what they are. So, Richard, what are estate duties?
Oh, estate duties are effectively a death duty. Like, let's not call it anything else. Your estate is, you know, your assets, and when you die, you hand them on. Most countries have some sort of death duties, and it's a great. People say, you know, death and taxes are unavoidable. Well, I'd much rather pay tax when I'm dead than when I'm alive. I just don't understand.
Surprise me when I'm dead.
Yeah, I don't understand people saying, oh, the government wants to take all my money when I'm dead. I'm like, well, you could have an income tax cut now and then you could pay some more tax when you're dead. So estate duties tick a lot of boxes, including that the tax is levied at a point in time where assets are getting handed from someone who has them to someone who's never had them before.
Yeah.
You know, and as the Nobel Prize winning economist, what was Becker's first name? I've forgotten. Anyway, he said half a windfall is still a windfall. You know, so taxing estates is a great way to collect a lot of revenue, not change any, distort any behaviours.
You could encourage people to live longer.
Well, I was going to say, in worst case scenario, people are so determined to avoid tax.
They'll just live forever.
They live a healthier life and do a bit more exercise and, you know, take their vaccines.
What about a carbon tax, Matt?
A great big new tax.
That's the carbon tax and the mining tax.
A carbon tax also did really, really well. It's great at changing behaviour. We know when we had a carbon tax in this country, a carbon price, for 2 years, emissions fell by more in those 2 years than any other two-year period, and that was because of the carbon price. Because you can, it collects money and you can hand it back as compensation, it's able to overcome things like problems with inequality and those that are best able to pay, and it's reasonably simple and difficult to avoid. So quite an effective tax.
Had to go.
It had to go. It was too effective. That was the problem. It worked.
And another good one seems to be the Buffett rule. What's a Buffett rule, Richard?
So Warren Buffett kind of once floated the idea that there should just be a minimum amount of tax, which you tax rate that you multiply by your gross income, your total income, and no matter how good your accountant, no matter how many deductions there are, no matter how clever your structuring is, you're just
there's a minimum that you've got to pay
because on your gross income.
Because he observed that his executive assistant paid more tax than he
had a higher tax rate.
There you go.
So her income was a lot lower, but she paid a higher tax rate than him. So the Buffett rule basically says, you know, look, you guys spend so much money on accountants and we've made the law so complex, you kind of win that game. So we're starting a new game called you can't pay less than, say, 15%.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it literally ticks all of our boxes, which is why no one's proposing it in Australia. Like the carbon tax, it would work.
Too effective.
Yeah.
There are reports Labor will dump its negative gearing and capital gains tax policies, which Bill Shorten took to the last two federal elections.
He also promised to wind back tax breaks on investment properties like negative gearing.
People in their 20s and 30s can't get their first house.
And without those franking credits, I will slip down below the pension threshold and have to claim a pension. It's not.
And so just to finish us up, we've got capital gains tax discount, superannuation tax concessions and excess franking credits, none of which I can see a lot of red here on the table.
Yeah, look, these are tax concessions. You know, basically they mainly benefit people who have the most. They are quite complicated and they're levelled at a time where it's difficult to pay. So for example, the capital gains tax discount, no matter how you earn income in Australia, whether it's from wages or interest on bank accounts or profit or dividends, however you happen to earn it, you pay your marginal tax rate, except if you happen to sit on an asset and sell it for more than you bought it for, in which case we say, oh, well, you can just pay half as amount of tax.
Yes. Would you like the 50% capital gains tax, Matt?
Discount.
Discount.
It's great.
Yeah,
it's
there's a hint in the name. The 50% capital gains tax discount is what it's actually called. Going cheap tax.
And we also know that over 80% of that goes to the top 10% of taxpayers.
Which might explain why we're not getting rid of it.
Yeah. And just to finish up, I can definitely say that excess franking credits are difficult to understand and definitely seem complicated because I think it took me the first 7 years of working here at the Australia Institute to even understand what they were.
That's quicker than most, Em. That's quicker than most. And again, that's the only reason they've survived. Mm. Like, no other country in the world has what Australia has, the cash refund for so-called excess franking credits. And by the way, everyone listening just tuned out and went, don't know what any of that means. But that's the strategy.
Yeah.
Like, if people understood, there would be a riot.
Yeah, exactly. John Oliver once said, the comedian said, if you want to do something evil, wrap it in something boring. Yeah. Excess franking credits is a classic example of that. If you don't understand it, it means you're not making out from it.
So overall, looking at where Australia's tax debate is at the moment, Richard, how are we doing?
Ah, terribly.
Tell us what you really think.
Well, we're not having a tax debate. Tax isn't good. Tax isn't bad. I have my personal preferences for which taxes are slightly better and slightly worse. But as I said before, like agreeing whether you want to discourage smoking or whether you want to reduce inequality, there are fundamental democratic questions about what are we trying to achieve. And once you've kind of agreed on those, you can cook up which are the taxes that would best get us there. But in Australia, we kind of have this bizarre debate where the starting point is always the status quo. Like, whatever we happen to have today is kind of chiseled in stone, handed to us on divine
tablets.
And if you want to change one, and anyone would be worse off if it was changed, then that's class envy, it's a war, it's divisive. Like, we're just literally not allowed to have a conversation about, is the tax system in 2021 working the way we'd want? Are we collecting tax on things we're trying to discourage? Are we doing it fairly? Are we doing it simply? You're not allowed to have that conversation. The only conversation you're allowed to have is which tax should we cut next? Mm-hmm. You know, so...
Because that's where you've only got winners when you cut the tax.
That's right. If you're cutting taxes, then, you know, there'll only be winners. But, of course, in the long run, there'll be losers. Mm. Because as a society, societies that collect more tax, in the long run, they can spend more money on services. And every time we succeed in cutting taxes, what we're really doing is agreeing to spend less on services at some point in the future.
Matt, is it time for us to campaign for a Buffett rule again?
Yeah, look, we said that nobody was proposing a Buffett rule, and that's true, neither of the major parties. But actually, the Buffett rule is incredibly popular amongst people.
It's, I think it's because they think it's buffet. The rule is they have to go to the buffet.
Go back for thirds. But like, it's incredibly popular. And the reason it's incredibly popular is because people realise it will actually work. You know, those millionaires who manage to get their gross income from over $1 million down to zero, they would still pay a huge amount of tax because they would have a minimum rate based on their gross tax.
That they absolutely have to pay and they can't get out of.
Yeah, and no matter how smart the accountant is, they will pay a set amount of tax, at least as a minimum.
So just to finish us up, Richard, why should we care about tax so much?
Well, because tax is the price we pay to live in a civilised society. Tax is an investment in that society. And we shouldn't get too caught up on whether every year the exact amount of tax we collect is exactly equal to the amount we spend. Like, don't have to get all caught up in the obsession with budget surpluses or balancing the budgets. But as a society, when we collect tax, we're doing a couple of things at the same time. We're potentially changing people's consumption decisions, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, or carbon pollution. So the tax can have a positive effect in changing behaviour. And it's also freeing up resources. If high-income earners could fly overseas twice as often or have a third holiday house, that's fine. That'll create jobs in the holiday house building industry. But if we take resources off them, if we collect tax from them, we could spend that money, for example, on public housing. So we get not just the benefits of taxing things we're trying to discourage, but we can actually change the entire shape of the income distribution and the shape of the economy itself, because we can, if we're taxing people with very high incomes, maybe they buy a smaller jet, maybe they're tripping to space.
They might share a jet with another family.
They might share a jet at summer, or maybe, you know, maybe their spaceship that they show their friends is a bit smaller and less luxurious. So think about the enormous amount of resources that went into Bezos and Musk's space race.
And who was the other one? Richard Branson. There's three of them.
Yeah,
now.
Right. So those resources, forget the money, the physical resources, the time that smart people spent, the scarce materials, the fuel, all of those resources could have been deployed doing something else. Mm. But when you've got people that rich, you know, who are bored with their 100-metre-long super yacht,
yeah,
it's time to get me a rocket ship, that's literally distorting the shape of our economy, the things we produce.
Yeah, and as Jeff Bezos said at the time, he thanked all of his employees for paying for it, which they literally
and the customers.
Yeah,
exactly. And that same,
not a hint of irony.
That's right. And that same money could have gone to universities, you know, around the world.
Jeff Bezos alone could face an extra annual tax charge of $5.4 billion. Elon Musk, $5.2 billion. And Bill Gates, $4 billion.
Everyone's like, oh, but there was some spillover benefit from them building a giant rocket ship. We learnt how to solve some problem. It's like, yeah there were other ways.
Yeah,
and there were other problems.
And, yeah, presumably, I mean, Amazon employs a lot of people. So does Virgin. So does, who was the other one? I can't remember.
Musk.
Tesla.
Yeah.
If they all gave their employees a pay rise, for example, that's a lot more money in the economy. So,
that's right.
Yeah,
well, what we now know
is
that wealth doesn't trickle down.
Yeah.
It blasts off.
Yeah. Into space.
Into space.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 3rd of August, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, including Matt's paper on the principles of what makes a good tax. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. And Matt Grudnoff is at Matt Grudnoff. That's GRUDNOFF. Our producer is Jennifer Macy. You can find her at Jennifer Macy. And our theme music is by Jonathan McFreet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. And if you want a refresher on what franking credits are all about, you can go back to our episode 42, What the Hell is Dividend Imputation? It's a great episode. Stay safe out there, stay safe in lockdown, and thanks for listening.